So Ralph, I've been thinking a lot about the co-laboring, and you know that's been really good. Do you have any suggestions on discerning how to know what my job is versus what God's job is?
Yeah.
Excellent. I'd love to hear that.
But it's a frustrating one.
Okay. I wouldn't expect anything less.
When you have repeated frustration and running into a stone wall, even burnout, it means that you're trying to do something that God is not in God's plan for you, i.e., you're not co-laboring with Him. Or more likely, you got the right field of endeavor, but you're trying to do the part that only God can do, or you're trying to get God to do the part that He has assigned to you and He won't do. And figuring that out is not easy, but it gives you some alternatives. It's one of those things. And when you're trying to accomplish something, and particularly if it's something that you were sure that God assigned you to do, and you're constantly having lack of success, it means that you're maybe in the right direction, but the wrong timing, or which simply means that you're probably running ahead of God. It's much easier to see what God is doing and might want to include you in than to see His timing. And I think that accounts for a lot of the frustration in our lives. And perhaps the first question to ask when you run into this frustration is, okay, God, what's the timing here? Am I trying to run ahead of you? Am I trying to make this happen in my timing rather than in yours? Very often that's the case, and it can at least give some relief to the frustration. The words "wait on the Lord" that you find sprinkled through Scripture are not there for nothing. They're there because whenever we feel God's call to do something, we get all wrapped up in it and excited about it, and off we go, and we're going to do something spectacular. At that point, he says, whoa, wait a minute. You know you're not going to do something spectacular. We are going to do something spectacular by you doing your part and me doing the things you can't do. So maybe you better slow down and try to figure out the difference between the two. What are these things that you can't seem to do and don't have the foggiest notion how to accomplish them? That's where you need to be praying and seeking the Lord. And those are the things that God's going to do. Yeah, He may choose to do them through you, but they're not things you're going to be able to see a process for. Say, oh, yeah, that has to get done. Now I'll first do A and then B and then C and it'll get done. That's probably not going to happen in those areas.
So how do goals work into that?
Well, the goal is the overarching goal that the Lord has given you. It's the vision. In biblical terms, goals are visions. Visions can be frightening. Who is it, Peters who called them BHAGs, big, hairy, audacious goals, but they're really visions. They're the things that you can see happening, but you can't see the process of how they might happen. Those are the things that the world says we need a lot of luck to get that done. And we say we need a lot of the Lord in that. And this we see over and over again in Scripture, where we see the God's heroes, the men of faith, who got kicked out of their comfort zone into a vision that was way beyond them. And the Lord just came through at critical times and brought things together that they couldn't have thought of and couldn't have done. And so you come to realize that in their case and in our case, the timing was all the Lord's. The Lord commissioned Moses to do what Moses didn't want to do, but God wanted to do, and he was going to do through Moses. But if Moses didn't feel comfortable going to Pharaoh, let alone going to Pharaoh seven times, I'm sure Moses said, well, okay, I'll screw up my courage and do it once, and then God's going to accomplish the setting the people free. Didn't work that way. And Terry was frustrated. You mean you want me to go back again? You're going to throw me in a dungeon? No, you go back again. And by the time, it got done, it was pretty clear to Moses that it wasn't his doing, but it was constantly the Lord. And put yourself in Moses' shoes, the building frustration. Hey, I got the vision, but this isn't working. You know, if he won't budge after what I did or what the Lord did, he's never going to budge. But then the Lord said, go back again. And I think that's the case with many of the visions that God gives us. If we're co-laboring with him, you know, he may not do it in one fell stroke. You may have to go through some more iterations and some more frustrations.
So, should goals have, you know, targeted dates?
You'd have to be a pretty extraordinary person with an extraordinary relationship with the Lord before he'd give you a vision, a goal, and a target date. I have not seen that in Scripture.
Well, there's a lot of them like that are like, well, you're going to do it now.
Yeah, but then it even Gideon, I don't see that happening. I mean, there were some various iterations and so on. And even when he put when he accomplished the defeat, now poor Gideon was in charge, and he had to kind of reorganize the people and be a leader, and he never asked for that.
I don't understand. I mean, things can kind of go along, but if you don't have a target date, I mean, I don't know.
When the Lord tells you to do something, the answer is yes, aye, sir, and right now. To start. But that's, you're talking about a completion target date. I've never seen one of those. It gives you an action and says, get started. And he gives you a vision of what it'll look like when it's completed, but not a date.
But there's steps along the process of any big vision.
Yeah, absolutely. And those steps are always right now.
So God doesn't, like, reveal, here's the next step, here's the next step, here's the next step?
He reveals, here's the next step. And when? Right now. Get started. I haven't seen him say, well, complete this assignment by such and such a day.
So did you have a goal to go ahead and company running without you? Did you have a goal to sell your company?
No. I didn't.
It just happened?
Oh, I got my company running without me because that appeared to me to be the right thing to do. I had middle management, and if I was going to give them a chance to be effective, I had to trust them to do things.
So why did you want your business running without you?
They're asking me.
Why did you want your business running without you?
Because the people that were working for me needed that challenge.
So you didn't start off with that intention?
Of selling the company? No.
Or getting the company to run without you?
Well, no. There are many reasons why you build up your middle management and get the company running without you. One of them is so that you can free yourself up to do more things for the company, like expanding it into new fields and this and that. I mean, I started with one operation on one airport, and I wound up with several other airports, most of which were mistakes, but that's another issue. The purpose, I guess, was to grow the business. And you can't grow the business if you're constantly involved in all the minutiae and details, A, and B, good people won't work for you if you're constantly micromanaging. That wasn't the relationship I wanted with my people. And mainly it's because I hate to be micromanaged, so I wasn't going to do it to them. Tell me what you want to get done, I'll go out there and figure out how to do it and do it. Don't stand over me and give me minutiae and tasks to fulfill. That just is not my style of following, so it's not my style of leading.
Why did you start your company?
Why did I start my company?
Yeah.
Because I saw a need, and so I decided to try and fill it. I started my company, I was in the general aviation business, but I started it to fill a need in avionics. At the time I started it, radios and navigation instruments and so on were important, but they were fairly primitive, and they were all it was not in today's market where you just replace modules and so on. You needed people to tweak them, and they were constantly in need of tweaking. And it was a pretty, and there weren't very many places in this state where you could get them worked on. And of course, if you had no radios, your radio crapped up, then you had to somehow go no radio to fly no radio to some radio shop. And I thought, well, obviously we need more service in the state. And so I got into that business. Then I realized that that business couldn't survive economically on its own. It needed needed the ancillary services that give you your daily bread, which was actually fuel sales, but also maintenance sales and the other things that we wound up doing. So that all just evolved. And I was learning as I went along.
So did you have any grand vision?
Not really. I was just trying to be useful. Now, that doesn't mean that a grand vision is not important. I had knew some people at the time were in general aviation business who started out at my age, young, and did have a grand vision, and they probably did it a lot better than I did. They figured out that they wanted to become a major factor in the general aviation industry, so they looked around for the best-run operations and sought a position as sort of assistant to the president, intern, whatever. And in the process, they learned a lot, and they got to know a lot of people in the industry. So when they went off on their own, started their own company, they had a great advantage over me, because I had to learn everything the hard way by figuring it out for myself, and I didn't know the people. At least not when I started out. So, yeah, a better vision probably would have been good for me. I just saw a need and said, "Hell, I just get in there and fix that."
So, you know, what I struggle with is I don't understand why I was given a vision, such a clear vision at such a young age and had so much intentionality. And
well, how does that work out?
I don't know.
Well,
I mean, I have no idea. I mean, you know, Joseph, you know, you ask him in prison, how's that working out for you, buddy?
Yeah.
I'm guessing he's going to say, he might go ahead and say just what I don't know. I mean,
well,
I mean, I don't know. I mean, if I look at it from human terms, it would be like, yeah, not so well. I mean, but even human terms, there's, you know, I'm probably still in the top, you know, 10% of the people in the world. So even in human terms, it's pretty good. I mean, so it depends on where your eyes are focused on. From God's perspective, it's like, there's been some pretty hard things, but, you know, I mean, life's not easy. He didn't promise. I mean, it's not. I mean, Moses went through some pretty tough times, and so stop being a wuss, Mark. And so it's all. it's all perspective, and I can take every perspective there is. I mean, I can see every perspective. I could legitimately say it's working terrible. I could say it's working pretty good. I could say it's working great. I can see all of it, which creates a confusion for me, because it's like, okay, I mean, if something's not wrong, if something's not broken, you don't fix it. I mean, Joseph, he's in prison. He doesn't need to fix anything, just needs to be faithful.
And he needed to, in order to keep from going nuts, he had to trust the Lord and follow the Lord day by day, realizing that prison was actually part of the thing. And what the Lord gave him to do at that time, the day-by-day thing, it was, Joseph, now get up and do your job here in the prison and do it excellently. Just take pride in it. And he did that, so he won a lot of favor. And whatever he did it with all his heart, because he realized that that was his assignment from the Lord that day. And so that was enough for him. Otherwise, he could not have survived and with his attitude intact. And that's what actually eventually got him out of prison. And he had a reputation in the prison. So while he was in prison, he had a certain sphere of influence, very limited. It didn't look like his vision at all, but he had a sphere of influence. He was like Paul, who was in prison, and yet he did the best he could with what he had. Well, actually, he had as much or more influence during the time he was in prison as he did the rest of his time. That's when he wrote the prison epistles, which, you know, to this day have huge influence. And what he did is he did that with joy and with excellency, even where he didn't know what when he would get out of prison. He didn't have a goal, as you would call it, a goal, by such and such a date you will. No, he just said, well, there is today, and today I'm going to do what the Lord assigns me to do, and what the Lord does with it, that's his part of the equation. I co-labor by doing what he calls me to do. He's called me. I can't do much, but I can control my attitude, and I can use whatever the Lord has given me to bless other people. Well, how can I bless other people? Well, first of all, he converted most of the Praetorian Guard, which was his immediate sphere of influence within that prison. It wasn't much more. And then he, for a time there, he was allowed visitors, so he preached to them and reasoned with them and so on. But then he just had a much larger vision, so how about to the uttermost parts of the earth? Well, that he could do by writing, and at least he had some contact through snail mail with his churches, and so he could engage himself really as a distance pastor for them, which is what his epistles really were. He was pastoring them from a distance. And he figured out, well, that's something I can do. Now, what the Lord does with those letters and they're received and how they're used, that's God's part of the co-laboring. It's my part to write, and even in the writing, I need God to anoint. So writing is very much of a co-laboring type of operation. So Paul was just day by day constantly co-laboring with the Lord step by step. During the early part of his ministry, it was Paul's job daily to preach, and God's part daily to heal him when the stones flew and left him for dead. God did the miracles, he did the preaching. And he trusted God to do his part, and he just did his part. And when you think of a guy being stoned and left for dead outside of town, and the Lord heals him, puts him back on his feet, and instead of getting the heck out of there, he goes back into the same town where they stoned him. You know, that's kind of a different kind of attitude, isn't it? That's really co-laboring in trust that the Lord, hey, if the stones didn't affect me the first time, they won't the second.
Sometimes I wonder, I wonder if I, you know, people get used to their lives, and what's going on in their life, and even if they're uncomfortable, even if they're in painful situations, it seems like people can become complacent or willing to stay there.
Yeah. Well, but I think we're all that way. I mean, you know, if you're not in that category right now, just wait a month or wait a year.
Well, that's what I'm concerned about, is that I am in that area, and it's like, you know.
Read Hebrews 12.
Okay, I will.
You know, when you get there, not if you get there, you can count on God to lovingly come and kick your butt. That's all I get out of Hebrews 12.
Wouldn't it be a lot better if I could see it before that?
Maybe you're asking too much of yourself.
I don't know.
I think the secret, I think, is to feel God's footprint when it's still light, so he doesn't have to kick you too hard before you understand what's going on.
I appreciate it, sir. Thank you.
Okay, my friend.
Anything I can do to pray for you?
You could be in prayer for my startup church. We need some direction. We're in the classical situation where we're trying to grow the church and God's trying to grow the kingdom. And we're trying to fit in with his plans, but not quite sure.
Exactly. What's your role in the church?
What?
What's your role in the church?
I don't have any official role except being part of it. Yeah. Trying to make it happen.
How long have you been trying?
I've been about 4 4 months, 5 months.
How many people?
Well, it depends on which Sunday. We were like down to 19 last Sunday. Of course, it's summer. But I think nominally we must have about 30.
Why did you start it?
I didn't.
Why did you participate in the person who started it?
Because I think the Lord led me to come alongside of him and encourage and support, and also because I had no ministry role at the church that I've been in for years. I needed and wasn't going to have any. And so the Lord wanted me to be more active in encouraging and ministering. So,
how old is he?
60.
Why did he start it?
Oh, well, he's been a pastor for 20 years. He was commissioned by a church that is, maybe 15, 20 miles from here to do an outreach church.
Huh. Is he discouraged?
I think he is a little right now. One of the things, you know, it got off to a fairly good start, but then we had some families in there that people had been unemployed, and one by one they managed to find employment in Arizona. And you know, in a small group like this, you take a family out.
Right.
And, you know, some things like that. We have nice gals there the last time, last Sunday. She got a job. She teaches hermeneutics. She's been a missionary in Kenya. She's gone to India to teach hermeneutics in a mission school out there. So now she's gone. You know, and that all may be well and good and right in God's plan, but we got to figure out what we're supposed to be doing. And it's kind of hard to do church without the dynamics that people expect, if you know what I mean.
I do.
And I don't think that's really the kingdom. But
yeah, my mom said multiple times, because my dad started 4 churches.
Yeah. Well, there you are.
And 3 of them are, you know, still operation. 1 did not make it, but 3 of them are, you know, self-supporting and functioning now, you know, on their own, independent. And so my mom would often say in the startup phases, she said, you know, if everybody that attended stayed with the church, that left the church, that didn't continue because we didn't have the programs, if they would have all stayed, we'd have had the programs.
Yeah, well, that's true.
So, yeah, no, I get what you're saying when you say, you know, people expect. You know, we go to a very large church now.
Yeah.
And it's intriguing. It's James McDonald's church of Walk in the Word. And so there's 7 campuses, you know, and so ours is all beamed in. And, you know, he's a great you know, expositor of the word.
Yeah.
But boy, do they have a system in place. They've set up a franchise model, actually.
Yeah, right.
They have over 100 other churches around the country, around the world. And in one of the Q&A times, somebody asked, you know, like Tom Koontz, you know, he was president of the, you know, largest real estate franchise in the world. And I was talking to him once, and he said normally it's about a 6% franchise fee.
Yeah.
And so somebody asked in one of the Q&A about all these other 100 churches all over the world, how does it set up structurally? And they're all independent, but they all pay 5% like a franchise fee to the, you know, to Harvest.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm not saying it's good or bad, it just is what it is, but it's very intriguing. But they have got it down. Man, they have got this thing down to a science.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, again, not being raised in that, I'm not, you know, I mean, we go and, but it you know, it does make it easier to sit in the pew, you know, or the chairs. It does make it easier to sit in the pew when you get all these systems in place. You don't, it doesn't force you to engage.
Well, see that. That, of course, is you know, I was asking him today, the pastor, I said, well, okay, you know, if you've got three pizza places in a small town and you want to start another pizza place, you got to ask the question, why do they need another one? What is it they're not getting that they need? That's kind of the situation. You've got to, in this country, there's churches.
Right.
Anybody wants to go to church and worship, can get in any one of them. They have not barred the doors. They won't throw you out. But the question is, what's the difference? Why do they need more? Well, you know, it seems to me that one thing that is different in most of these, there is no pastoral role. You go there, you do not have a pastor. If you're facing real difficulties in your life, by and large, there isn't somebody that, in most of them, that you trust enough, that you have enough access to get pastoral service. You get good preaching, you get good music, you get all of these advantages of a big organization, but you, by and large, don't get the intimacy of good small groups and the pastoring. So,
well, I will keep that in prayer and give that some thought, and that'll give me some good conversation to talk to my dad even.
Yeah.
And
been there, done that, hasn't he?
Yeah. Yep, he knows what that's like.
Well, ask him this question.
Sure.
You went out and started a new church four times, presumably in an area where there were other churches.
Yep.
Not as though you went up in the mountains somewhere where there was no church.
Yep.
And what were you offering that was not readily available to the people you were offering it to?
I will ask him that question.
What was the difference? Why did they need another one?
I will ask him that question.
Dude.
All right. Thank you, Ralph. Appreciate it.
Bless you.
You too. Bye-bye.